Good morning. Our last case this morning is 2020-415, the State of Ohio versus Kahari A. Bond. For the appellant, Ms. Schumacher.
Chief Justice O'Connor, fellow justices, may it please the court. Jody Schumacher, on behalf of appellant, State of Ohio, representing Richland County. I ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honors, the state is asking this court to correct the error of the Fifth District in not applying plain error analysis to the partial closure of the courtroom during the course of trial, on that partial closure having resulted from a near brawl breaking out outside that courtroom during a recess immediately following an identifying witness's testimony. Now, we're not asking the court to find anything inconsistent with current case law that this court has held, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court. We're simply asking to apply the current law and correct the error of that Fifth District. Additionally, even under the structural error analysis, I believe the Fifth District erred in finding error, and I can explain that. The state recognizes that the right to the open trial is certainly a fundamental right, but is a right that has to yield at times. And this court has recognized that that right has to yield, including to the administration of justice. The court has recognized that trial courts have authority to control the process, to control their courtroom, and they have discretion in order to do so.
So, counsel, the trial court judge in this case limited the attendance to strictly family members. Is that correct?
Family members of both the defendant as well as the victim and the press, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about the and the press. I didn't see in the record where the exception was that the press would be allowed to attend.
So strictly reading the record, Your Honor, I understand the court's concern. However, in the state's brief, merit brief to the court over objection of counsel that was permitted, there's footnotes referencing the newspaper articles that were written on behalf of this trial or during the course of this trial. They're also dated. Additionally, during the record or on the record, there is reference, Your Honor, to the court reporter. The local reporter's name is referenced and whether him writing an article would be permitted or not, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect that he or she was allowed to remain in the courtroom after the restriction?
Your Honor, you're correct. It does not specifically indicate that, but because there is a finding or there isn't an articulated finding that he be permitted, I believe that that it's not critical to this case in that the court has said it's okay to go ahead and look to the findings or the entire record as a whole.
So are you saying that the court or that the press was not specifically excluded? So you're saying that the press was allowed?
That is a very good point, Your Honor. Exactly.
Okay. So was the press there?
Yes, the press was present and remained present throughout the entire duration of the remaining witnesses, as well as jury instructions, and then even came in during pronouncement of verdict, Your Honor.
We know that because of the articles that were subsequently written contemporaneously with what happened in the court that day. Is that correct?
You're exactly right, Madam Justice, right. Chief Justice, yes.
But did the trial court judge make a record of that fact that the press would be allowed to remain and the only other participants were family members from both sides? Did he make a record of that?
Your Honor, the court did not directly articulate that. You are correct in observing that.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Schumacher, no party sought to close the hearing, correct?
That is, yes, Your Honor, that is a great observation.
And so did the trial court discuss any alternatives on the record?
Yes, I believe that the court did discuss alternatives on the record. I point the court specifically to the transcript on page 266. There, the court, in coming back or taking testimony just prior, the trial court instructed those present, stating that everyone is to be on their best behavior or else no one will be watching. I think that in and of itself demonstrates that the court had considered alternatives to that partial closure. In addition, I would point the court to Sewell, where again, this court found that even though the record lacked specific articulated findings, this court stated that because partial closure is more narrow than full closure, alternatives were in fact considered, Your Honor.
But did the trial court actually make specific findings to support whatever level of closure it believed was appropriate?
Specific findings, no, Your Honor. But as the Sewell court, as Drummond, and as Weaver versus Massachusetts has states, we need to look to that whole the entire record. And it would be unconvincing, to quote Weaver, the U.S. Supreme Court, they stated, it'd be unconvincing to deem a trial fundamentally unfair just because the court omitted to announce factual findings before making an otherwise valid decision to close a courtroom.
Okay, so I want to just follow up with that. Weaver is in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel, but Waller is in the context of structural error. Can we keep those two differences clear? Because I don't think we can combine those two very effectively.
I think we can keep, Your Honor, these differences. And remember in Waller, and this goes to the plain error analysis, Waller is different because there was an objection at trial, and over trial counsel's objection, the court still closed the courtroom. And Weaver is different because Weaver, although it was a post-conviction argument, there was no lodging or notice of error prior to that post-conviction appeal. So I believe that's a distinction without a difference, regardless if it's post-conviction, regardless if it's appeal. The difference is the same, or the result is the same. If we don't find, go ahead.
Are you saying though that if structural error is not, if structural error is not objected to before the trial court, that somehow this morphs into a plain error analysis? And I mean, is that what you're saying?
Essentially, yes, Your Honor. And this is following the Weaver court's decision, as well as, and I think the Fourth District did a great job explaining this. The Fourth District of Ohio in Tabor did a great job of explaining this. So we have essentially two structures. If there is objection lodged at trial, we go immediately to structural error. And structural error still stands. If error is found, it has to result in an automatic reversal without any consideration to harm. However, if there is no objection at trial, and recognizing that the trial court is in the best position to cure any defect, to cure any error, if we first notice that at appeal, at that point, there has to be a demonstration under plain error that one, there was error, that the error was obvious, and that the result would have been different but for that.
But structural error goes to constitutionality. And if you think about the essence of democracy and public trials, I mean, when we look at countries where they have closed trials, that the public can't be there, that the media isn't allowed in, and maybe could only report based on what somebody was in the courtroom. I mean, aren't we, structural error can never be waived. How do I reconcile that?
Your Honor, we are not waiving structural error, and we're not saying that structural error was in fact waived. The public's interest for public trial was met here. Media was present, Your Honor. Additionally, the defendant's rights were being were held at bay here, in the sense that the defendant's immediate family, consistent with In re Oliver, was present. And there's nobody else that has the defendant's interests more at heart than his own family members. They were present in this hearing. And in addition, we have victims immediately family ready or present, further acknowledging the public interest as well as the victim rights interests, Your Honor.
We don't have secret tribunals without good cause for that. And there needs to be something in the record that supports that and that shows that the trial judge limited that as much as possible, because that's like the essence of our democracy. How do we deal with this?
I don't disagree, Your Honor, that that the closure of a courtroom is very important and needs to be greatly accepted and rare at best. However, there was a substantial interest here. Because this was a partial closing, there was a substantial interest, and that was the administration of justice. There was a second disruption, and that is noted in the record in the transcript at page 256. If you follow DeArco Stillwell's testimony and cross-examination that morning, you can feel the tension building in that transcript. And it builds to the point where, trial counsel, defense counsel, had requested the court to order the spectators within the courtroom to refrain from commenting. So we had that. And immediately following, then 10 pages later, when we take the recess, as soon as DeArco Stillwell steps off the stand, we then have the near brawl that resulted in breaking the candy machine, of damaging courtroom or courthouse property. So that substantial interest in, one, ensuring that we proceed without interruption, ensuring that due process can be received by that defendant, that undue prejudice is not imparted by these unruly spectators, Your Honor. I believe the court was well-founded under the guise of that substantial interest.
Isn't one of the reasons that there's not more findings in the record because there was no objection? If someone had objected, the judge would have had to, presumably would have explained more why he or she was doing what they did, right?
I agree, Your Honor. In addition, I think it can't fall on this court to recognize the fact that potentially defense recognized the reason there is no objection is because they went along with and felt that this was in fact in his client's best interest. You can see by the court's response in using the term, "We are closing the courtroom," and a more than a 20-minute break, despite announcing a 10-minute break, despite that 20-minute break was announced, I believe that demonstrates that this was contemplated and trial counsel perhaps felt this was in fact in their best interest. I appreciate your court's time. I recognize I am out of time. And at this point, I ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Mr. Koenig, you have to unmute yourself, sir.
I've lost time because of Zoom, Your Honors. Honorable Justices, Ms. Schumacher, if it pleases the court, my name is Charles Koenig. I represent the defendant appellee, Kyrie Bond. Your Honors, quite simply, I would say to this court that on the basis of the existing law, as law currently stands today, there is no reason for this court to overturn the Fifth District's decision in this case. What clearly happened in this case was a closure. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
Counsel, what about the fact that the Fifth District didn't seem to follow the U.S. Supreme Court precedent? I mean, we have the U.S. Supreme Court saying in Johnson that rejecting the argument that harmless error does not, plain error does not apply to unraised structural error claims. So how do we deal with those cases where the Supreme Court seems to have said the exact opposite of what the Fifth District said?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't believe that the Supreme Court has ever said that.
Supreme Court said in Johnson, quote, "The seriousness of the error does not remove consideration of it from the ambit of the federal rules of criminal procedure." Then the court went on to reject the argument that structural errors were outside of plain error review.
Your Honor, that is correct. And they did say that in the dicta. What I'm saying is I don't believe the Supreme Court has ever said that plain error analysis is to apply to a structural error violation.
Well, they actually seem to have said just that. You have Johnson, you have Marcus, you have Puckett, where the court consistently seems to say that plain error analysis does apply to these things.
Well, Your Honor, I would have to respectfully disagree with that because although I understand what the court said and I've read those things, I believe what the court is talking about there is that there are situations where a plain error analysis should be considered. But what I'm saying is that the Supreme Court has never stated that plain error analysis is to be applied to a structural error.
To be fair, it's come pretty close. It says structural error, and Weaver, it said, carries with no talismanic significance. It means only that the government is not entitled to deprive the defendant of a new trial by showing the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think that is, in fact, the critical thing that Weaver said with respect to this case, Your Honor.
Right.
What
Weaver said was that if the defendant raises the error, what structural error can mean is that there's no ability for the state to say that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't indicate that when an error is raised, that there is no plain error analysis. In fact, it seems to say just the opposite. I mean, you have four Supreme Court cases that seem to say pretty clearly the exact opposite of what you're arguing.
Your Honor, and looking at Weaver, the most recent one of all, what Weaver was concerned about, Your Honor, was the fact that the structural error violation was not raised in a direct appeal. And in fact, what it said specifically in that case, if I could quote that, is that the factors and circumstances that might justify a temporary closure are best considered in the regular appellate process and not in the context of a later proceeding, a collateral attack. What the Weaver court said, Your Honor, was bring this before the attention of the appellate court and a direct appeal. You can do that as we did in this case here, Your Honor. This case is a case where we brought the structural error violation up on direct appeal. There's nothing then that changes the nature of that error being a structural error. There's nothing that transforms it into an error that suddenly means it's no longer structural.
Counselor, did you object at the trial court level?
No, Your Honor, there was no objection at the trial court level. And Your Honor, I would say that while that may be an error on the part of the defense counsel, it doesn't change the nature of the violation. The violation is still a deprivation of a public trial right that was committed by the trial court. It's the trial court judge that is responsible for safeguarding the protections, the constitutional protections of the defendant. And in this case, it was a trial court that violated those protections.
But not all questions from the courtroom rise to the level of structural error, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And in fact, that's a very, very good point, that there's only about a half a dozen instances where there's structural error. And if what we were to say is those items, those instances of structural error require defense counsel to object at trial before they're treated as structural error, Your Honor, we lose structural error then for things such as not giving the defendant the right to have his own attorney present, not giving the defendant the right to participate as counsel, forcing the defendant to be tried before a biased court. If it's not objected to, the discrimination of a juror pool, if we say, well, it depends on whether your attorney was smart enough to object at trial, and if he's not smart enough to object at trial,
counsel, I would agree with you if this was a complete closure. Which I think would be a very different situation. And I doubt whether the defense attorney would have agreed to this, but apparently, at least based on what I understand of the record and based on the prosecutor's position here, this was an agreed upon procedure for a partial closure that allowed for the essential members of the public, that is his family, to be there. And more importantly, the press was there, and the press did cover it, write about it, and disseminate what was going on in the courtroom.
Your Honor, there's a lot in that I need to respond to. The first thing is that defense counsel did not agree to this, Your Honor. The defense counsel was foolish enough to go along with it and not object to it. but he did not agree to it. He did not ask the court for closure. The second thing is the record is devoid of any evidence that the press was allowed to attend. In fact, I would say the exact opposite. The court was clear that only immediate family members would attend. The fact that there's evidence outside the record that the court would be willing to consider as evidence that the press was there, I'm unfamiliar with that standard of review, Your Honor, but at the same time, I don't believe that because there was articles written that evidence is the fact that the press was present. Your Honor, yesterday I read an article about the new rover mission on Mars. I'm fairly certain that the author of that article was not on Mars, but he wrote about it. And you can write about things without being there. Police blotters are in the paper all the time without the writer being present at the scene of whatever that criminal activity was that's in the paper. And Your Honor, many times the press receives their information as a result of somebody from the court, usually the prosecutor's office, calling and let them know what happened at trial. So there's no evidence in the record that the press was present. However, Your Honor, even if the press was present, the court needs to remember that in State versus Drummond, the court did find the press was present there. And nevertheless, the court found that it was a closure, and it was a partial closure. And as a result of which, the court went through the Waller analysis to determine whether the closure was constitutionally permitted.
The Waller analysis. Counsel, if we were to adopt your position that says that any structural error is automatic reversal, what incentive would counsel ever have to object? And wouldn't the prudent counsel's best policy be to say, okay, let's wait to see how this trial turns out. I won't object. It'd be bad for my client to object. And then if I lose, I get an automatic do-over.
Yeah,
that seems contrary to everything that we learn about the purpose of the rules of appellate procedure.
Your Honor, first of all, it's not my position that structural requires automatic reversal. It's the United States Supreme Court's position,
with all due respect, counsel, that's not their position. They've never said that. They've said the opposite. You're arguing for a different position, but go ahead.
The United States Supreme Court has not said that structural error requires automatic reversal.
They have not said structural error. What they have said is that structural error, that there are categories of structural error that may preclude the state from arguing that error was harmless.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I stand corrected. You are absolutely right that what it says is the government cannot say, deny the defendant a new trial by proving a harmless error. I agree with that. To me, that is the same thing as saying, ergo, you are entitled to automatic reversal.
It's not the same thing. It's a different prong of the test, right? I mean, harmless error applies when there is an objection. Plain error applies when there's no objection.
The second part of my response to your question, Your Honor, is that, yes, defense counsel all the time uses strategies for the purpose of not only trying to win a trial, but thinking about what to do later on in an appeal. I don't believe, however, that when you look at constitutional errors, only the few that have been elevated to the level of structural errors, when you look at those constitutional errors and realize that there's only a few of them, and those few errors say that this is the result, this is what should happen then when this error is committed. I don't believe that counsel's performance at trial should in any way affect that.
Let me just get you to answer the question. The strategic thing for counsel to do in a situation like this is not object.
No, Your Honor, it is not the smart thing to do. By virtue of closing the trial to the public, Your Honor, and not following the constitutional requirements of closing.
But why would counsel ever want to object in this situation? It's win for counsel if they don't object, if we adopt your rule, because either counsel, they get two bites of the apple, right? They have a trial and they can see if their client's found not guilty. If not, they get an automatic do-over. So why would you ever object?
Because, Your Honor, the purpose of trial counsel is to win the trial. It's not to continue to have more trials and more trials and more trials. by virtue of the of a closure of the trial to the public, it tears the very fabric of the trial framework apart, Your Honor, and it destroys the integrity. It destroys the ability to be able to make sure that there are people in the audience that can watch the
correct, Mr. Koenig. But as you admitted earlier, all closures are not violative of the defendant's constitutional rights.
No, Your Honor, I did not say that. In fact, I think all closures are violative unless there is compliance with Waller or Drummond, that where the overriding purpose or the substantial reason for the closure, in fact, overcomes the right to a public trial. Closing the public trial is a structural error. When you close the trial to the public, you deny the defendant.
Okay, but this was not a complete closure, correct?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a difference between a complete closure and a partial closure from a standpoint of how it affects the defendant. The only difference is whether everybody's excluded versus a couple of people excluded. Your Honor, in Drummond, when the court determined that that was a partial closure, the press was there, the family was there, and an extensive number of people in the family were there. In this case, you only had a couple of people there, no evidence that the press was there.
Counsel, Drummond's flaw was that there was not a substantial reason for the closure.
Correct, Your Honor. And in fact, okay, that is the reason.
All right. So it really doesn't rely on the press being there, the family, et cetera. Exactly. It was the fact that there was no substantial reason found by the appellate court. So in this case, you've had the tension mounting. You have, obviously the two adverse groups. You have violence in the hallway. And so the judge considers a partial closure as the least restrictive, response. And the attorney for the defendant does not object. Now, you say did not agree. I think the opposing counsel would characterize it as acquiescing to the closure for the safety of client and client's family. So the substantial, we're focusing here, or I'd like you to focus, on the substantial reason rather than an overriding interest. The overriding interest is the closure, total closure. Substantial is for partial closure. We have a partial closure. Do we not have a substantial reason?
Your Honor, correct. And Your Honor, I believe that the court is relying an awful lot about on things that the state put in their brief. That's not part of the record. There was no reasons articulated in the record by the judge as to why he did the closure. There was an altercation in the hallway, is all we know. There was tension in a murder trial. I don't believe that that's anything strange about a murder trial. There's no indication there were fisticuffs. There's no indication anybody was hurt. In fact, we don't even know who was involved. For all we know, it was the witness and the victim's family that was involved, and the defendant had nothing to do with it. We don't know that any of the witnesses were there when it happened, that anybody was threatened. We don't know that the jurors knew about it. We know nothing about the altercation based upon what's in the record. There is no substantial reason in the record. There's substantial reasons set forth in the state's brief, but you can't find that in the record. And the Fifth District, which did a painstaking analysis of everything that was in the record, found that there was no substantial reason stated by the court in the record. There just isn't a substantial reason for the closure. The judge just decided he wanted to close the courtroom because a gumball machine got broke in the hallway. And you can't tell anything more than that. Not even who was it.
Counsel, you've frozen on screen.
The things that would safeguard the defendant's constitutional right to a public trial. None of that was there. Okay, so there's no substantial reason shown, and there's nothing that the court did to figure out, is there something less we can do than exclude everybody? Because, Your Honor, in my brief, I raised six error, in my brief to the appellate court, I raised six assignments of error. Some of them included the fact that that witnesses changed their testimony, that there was inconsistent testimony, that there was prosecutorial misconduct. All of that stuff is safeguarded when the public is there to watch, listen, and say, I know that person's lying. And there's nobody in the courtroom who could say that. All that was left in the courtroom on the defendant's side was his mother and his sister. And they weren't there. They didn't know anything. They don't know the witnesses. Your Honor, there was no substantial reason articulated. There was no alternative methods considered. There was no reasons put on the record. No matter what, partial or total closure, Waller and Drummond were both ignored by the court. The court simply closed the courtroom because a gumball machine got broke in the hallway. And Your Honor, again, with all due respect to all of you that have questioned whether the Supreme Court has said structural error doesn't require a different treatment, if you will, when that occurs. It is the essence of the very fundamental characteristic of structural error is that you cannot tell whether the outcome of the trial was adversely affected. You can't figure out what was the harm from that occurring. And to say that, well, we're going to place now the burden on the defendant to prove prejudice because counsel didn't object is taking away constitutional rights for, in my mind, no good reason, no compelling reason.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Koenig.
Thank you for your time.
Your Honors, to reiterate, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just one question that I've been wanting to ask. So we're in the direct appeal process, and Weaver has said, which was decided in an ineffective assistance of counsel setting that was not related to a direct appeal, but more post-conviction. So we still have the chance to let the trial court correct the situation, because if we affirm the Fifth District, the trial court has to do it over again. And so we don't need to apply that thinking of plain error and proving those elements of plain error, because we're still in direct appeal process. Am I right here?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree, but if the courts, Your Honor, if you want to stay under the structural error analysis, the state would submit that there is no, we still can't demonstrate error because in fact, the trial court had a substantial interest in closing the courtroom. It was in fact narrowly tailored. Alternatives were considered. And although the findings were not expressly placed on the record, the entire record demonstrates that it was the appropriate decision.
Counsel, what in the record supports the substantial reason for the partial closure? Your opposing counsel is adamant that there is no nexus between the violence in the hallway to the attendees at trial, that there's no testimony, there's no evidence that they were even, I guess, linked. So what did the judge find, state on the record, articulate, whatever, to support the substantial reason?
So articulating this is a substantial reason, he does indicate that there was an altercation in the lobby. He does indicate that I believe his words were a M&M machine or was broken. Words alone do not result in a machine or property being broken. So I think it's context. To answer your question, Your Honor, it's context.
Okay, when counsel, was there evidence that this was done by the people who were associated with this trial?
I believe so, Your Honor. When reading that entire transcript, the court does state that it was not family that was involved. Additionally, then what other interests of anybody? This immediately followed on identifying witnesses' testimony. after tension was rising, after in that courtroom, there was directives to the gallery or requests to that gallery to refrain from commenting. You feel that tension. I agree, Your Honor, there aren't specific findings, but it's in the record, the entire record, that it can be imparted that the administration of justice was at risk here and it was necessary to partially close this courtroom.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you.
Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.